And good evening. It is getting close. Close to Election Day on the eve of the final weekend. This is the last chance for Joe Biden and for the president to sway voters. We'll focus tonight on every place that could make a difference this time and everything that's different compared to 2016. Now, already we've seen record early voting. You know that. In Texas, in fact, more ballots have already been cast than the entire total 4 years ago, early and day of voting combined. That's, of course, a big difference. But driving it and hanging over it all is the pandemic. Today saw cases top 9 million. And just moments ago, the country hit yet another new sad record for daily cases, more than 89,000 and 888 lives lost. The final numbers won't be calculated until after midnight, so cases will almost certainly top 900,000. Excuse me, 90,000. 90,000 today. The deaths will also continue rising at the current rate. About 40 people will die over the course of the next hour. Well, I'm on the air tonight talking to you, and you're listening at home or maybe at the gym or listening in your car. 40 Americans will die. Some of those deaths are preventable if more people would wear masks, but not enough of us care to, including the president. Joe Biden, Kamala Harris continue to hold socially distanced campaign events. The president and vice president continue to hold campaign events that make it easy for the virus to spread. The president is all in on lying about the virus now. He's telling crowds of maskless people crammed together that they are social distancing and wearing masks. He's saying the virus is going away. It's not, of course. It's spreading. He says the doctors are lying about the death toll. They aren't. The death toll is actually underreported. Do Americans care about these lies, these insults? Well, we'll find out in about 4 days if there are any consequences for the president. And for the jaded among you, if you're wondering how long it would take for the president to remind us all what a total lie his so-called endorsement of mask wearing was just yesterday, here he is today in Michigan with a shout out to a mask wearing Fox News host in the crowd.
Where is Laura? Where is she? Where is Laura? I can't recognize you. Is that a mask? No way. Are you wearing a mask? I've never seen her in a mask. Look at you. Oh, she's being very politically correct.
It took the wise owl in that old TV commercial less time to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop than it did for the president to make a sucker out of anyone who believes he has changed his tune on this or any COVID-related subject. He hasn't, and he won't. Here he is at the same rally claiming doctors are getting rich from COVID.
Our doctors get more money if somebody dies from COVID. You know that, right? I mean, our doctors are very smart people. So what they do is they say, I'm sorry, but, you know, everybody dies of COVID. But in Germany and other places, if you have a heart attack or if you have cancer, you're terminally ill, you catch COVID, they say you died of cancer. You died of heart attack. With us, when in doubt, choose COVID. It's true. No, it's true.
No, it's not true. Doctors and nurses are risking their lives. They very possibly saved the life of that man right there. And this is how our president treats them, our frontline heroes. It's not enough for this self-described wartime president to get our fellow citizens hating and fighting one another. He's now trying to get us to turn on the very people who are defending us on the front lines, fighting this virus. And his supporters nod their heads there. They cheer and they jeer. That is what we have become. As cases have been rising, more people have been getting sick enough to be hospitalized. 14 states today reaching record numbers. And even though treatment has improved since the early days, deaths have begun rising again as well. So no, Mr. President, it's not that we're testing more, because in some states, with your encouragement, we're actually testing less. It's not that doctors are trying to earn extra cash from people dying and faking death counts, which is obscene. They're risking their lives along with nurses and hospital staffs to save others. The numbers are rising and more people are getting sick and dying because we're in the middle of a raging pandemic that you have failed to deal with from the very beginning. Today, Florida, that key battleground state, became only the third state, along with California and Texas, to pass the 800,000 case mark, according to the data team at Johns Hopkins University, reporting more than 5,100 new infections just today. More now on how Florida, Texas, and all the current Midwest hotspots fit into the electoral picture as people adapt to voting on what are now quite literally life and death issues. Our chief national correspondent, John King, joins us for that. So, John, how does the collision of the virus and the campaign impact the president in these final days?
To your point you were just making, Anderson, this is everybody's daily lives, and what the president is telling them right now is not the truth. So four nights from now, we will fill this in with red and blue. That's traditionally how we judge politics. Which way do the states go? Add up the electoral votes, we get a president. But this is the headwind the president is running against right now, and it is COVID in America. It is not Democrat or Republican or independent. It is life for everybody. And just look at this map. The red is pain. The pink is pain. The orange is pain. This is COVID cases per 100,000 residents. The darker the color, the higher the rate. It's everywhere. So I'm actually a little bit reluctant to do this because it is everywhere in America. But think about where the president was today. It's a lot of pain in Michigan in recent months. Even more pain in Wisconsin. Look at all that red, especially right now. Minnesota has also had problems, including in rural areas that are very important to the president. Senator Harris was in Texas today. Democrats think, it's a sick thing to say in some ways, but the coronavirus works to their advantage because they want leadership to be the issue. Look how hard Texas has been hit. The vice president was in Arizona. Remember the summer surge? How much pain we went through out there? When you look at this map, everywhere in America, but especially in battleground America, there's a lot of problems right now. That is one way to look at the impact on this campaign. Let me make this go away and just show you one other way we can look at the campaign. Use the 2020 map here. You bring this out. The top 10 states right now, COVID growing right now. Again, it's growing everywhere. But the top 10 states per capita, this is them. This is how they voted in 2016. All of them voted for President Trump, including battleground Wisconsin, a key part of the campaign today. One other quick way to look at this, Anderson, you come here and you look at this. Where are new confirmed cases? Where are they rising the fastest? These are the top 10 states. You go back to 2016. Seven of them voted for the President of the United States. Battleground Texas, battleground Florida, the Midwest area that is key to this campaign. So no matter where you look at the numbers, they're sober and they're getting worse. And you look at the political overlay, this is a tough race for the president because of this virus.
And for Joe Biden, how does the surge in the pandemic affect his strategy?
It doesn't, and that's actually the point. Joe Biden has been running from the beginning on leadership. I know how to run the government. I will be competent. We will deal with this virus. And the president's trying to change the subject. I just want to show you some other numbers. We can use the 2016 map to do it as you go through it. The president keeps trying to change the subject. But look in Michigan, for example, again, a key battleground state. Poll out this week, 42% approve, 55% disapprove on the virus. The virus is rising right now. It is front and center. President wants to make it about law and order. He wants to make it about crime and taxes. The virus is in his face. The trend lines for Joe Biden, this is Trump's handling of the coronavirus in battleground Wisconsin. 39% approve now, 44% did just a month ago. The numbers are going the wrong way for the president, 59% disapprove. So the Biden campaign knows this numbers. They know the case count in America. They want to focus on leadership and competence. And as the president tries to change the subject, the coronavirus is the headwind.
I mean, the president does have a path to 270 electoral votes. I mean, what is that path? Because I'm seeing a lot of articles about concerns among Democrats about turnout among African-Americans, among Hispanic voters in Florida and Arizona and some other states.
So let's go through this map. Look, there's 2016 PTSD among Democrats without a doubt, number one. Number two, even in places where they have an advantage in early voting, that doesn't guarantee you victory. That means you have a head start. Right. You have more people on the track early. You still have to finish the race. So this is the execution part of the race. This is the president's map 4 years ago. Right. Can he replicate this? Well, let's come here and look at this. Now, this is different. Right. This looks different than the maps I've showed you. Let me tell you why. This is where we rate the race right now. If you want to come, let me come back here. If you want to come through everything right now, we have Joe Biden states leaning that get him across the finish line. But what we've decided to do is take all the states that we lean Texas to the president. Let's pull that back. We lean Arizona and Nevada to the Democrats. Let's take those back. The same with the blue wall states up here. So if you think of this as the final week of the campaign, how does the president get there? Well, he starts with 125. So let me get him close, Anderson. I won't get him the whole way. But he has to win Texas, which is very competitive. He has to win Florida. He has to win North Carolina. He has to win Ohio. He has to win Iowa. Even if he did that, he's only at 231. That's where it gets interesting because everywhere else on this map right now, everywhere else on this map, Joe Biden is either leading or ahead. So, yes, the president has a path, but he has to be perfect.
John King, stay there. I want to bring in our chief political correspondent, Dana Bash, also veteran campaign insider, CNN senior political analyst David Gergen. Dana, this is obviously the final sprint, over three days to go, both Trump and Biden making, you know, dashes to battleground states. The ground game in this moment, can you explain what that term really means? Because, again, I keep reading these articles about in Florida that the turnout, the early voting by African Americans, by Hispanics for on the Democratic side, there are concerns about it as well as in other states. I don't know the details on it.
There are concerns. There are concerns among Democrats that they are underperforming among African Americans and Latinos, especially in Florida. Democrats I've talked to all day today and frankly all week say that, you know, just be careful. Obviously, those numbers vary in different states. But to answer your fundamental question about the ground game, what does that mean? What it should mean, what it traditionally means is a campaign has a sense of where their potential voters are and they go get them. And they have a whole operation in order to do that. And over the past, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, even more, the Republicans, since Obama, the Republicans picked up on the way that President Obama did it in a masterful way. And they learned from it and they used technology and all of the advances in technology so that what they have right now is, and I went out in Western Pennsylvania where the Trump campaign right now is trying to boost its turnout even more than it did 4 years ago, which is why President Trump won Pennsylvania, because the red areas went so big. And on their phones, Anderson, they have an app. And on that app, it tells them which house to go to. And when they get to that house, who to ask for. And when they ask for that person, what the script is that will best try to persuade that voter based on what they know their likes and dislikes are. I don't believe that the Democrats have anything like that. But much more importantly, because of COVID, Democrats pulled back for a really long time. Republicans never did.
David, the president's path narrower than Biden's, obviously, as John was talking about. There is the path for him to win. We all know what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016. She didn't spend time in Rust Belt states. Polls ended up being wrong. What variables do you think could be in play this year?
What variables are in play? Well, I think right up until the election itself, the way that Donald Trump is responding to the pandemic is they're giving him a lot of rope on the Democratic side, and he's increasingly hanging himself. His comments today about doctors are milking the system so they can get rich off pandemic. It's just so odious. And to go after Laura Ingraham like that was just wrong-headed. You know, I think increasingly for Americans, there are 4 days left before voters can rid us of this madman.
John, I mean, looking at the industrial swing states, what did they tell us about the race right now?
Right. And so let's drill in on that point, because I can game you out so many 270 scenarios that get it close. And then what do they come down to? The three most spoken words in presidential politics since 2016, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. What do they look at? This is Trump's map. This is Trump map from 4 years ago, right? Right now, in those three right there, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Joe Biden is leading, and he has leads 6.7 points even bigger when you count him out. So what is the state of the race in those? You're talking about the polls and the skepticism, and boy, do I get it, and boy, do Democrats get it. But I just want to make a point here. If you look at the national polls, our poll of polls, a 10-point average for Joe Biden. Michigan, 51-43, so you see 8 points there. 51-44, 7 points in Pennsylvania, 52-43, 9 points in Wisconsin. So here's what the president needs, again, because Democrats think they're doing pretty well in early voting in these states in particular. The president needs a mind-blowing Election Day turnout, not just a big turnout, not just a 2016 turnout. He means a mind-blowing turnout, because look where the president is. 43%, 44%, 43%. Yes, Biden's above 50, but more significant is the president is stuck in the low 40s, and he doesn't have the third-party candidates to help him this time. He got 47.6 in Michigan 4 years ago. Getting from 43 to 47, he did that 4 years ago. It's not enough this time. Getting from 44 to 48 or 49 might not be enough in Pennsylvania. 43 to 48 might not be enough in Wisconsin. So can he do it? Yes. People came out of the woodwork. They did a remarkable job. Dana notes the turnout operation. They did a remarkable job 4 years ago. That's why Democrats are nervous. A lot of it also was organic for Trump. Mm-hmm. It has to happen again on an even bigger scale.
Well, John, I mean, how, you know, to Dana's point about the ground game, and Democrats were, you know, slow to it because of COVID and trying to do it in a way that's more responsible and protect election workers. I mean, how confident should Democrats be about turnout on Election Day? I mean, if there's concerns in Florida about, you know, early turnout, early voting among African Americans and Latino voters, why should they be confident about who turns out on Election Day?
You will find different concerns in different states. Sometimes you find different concerns within the same state if it's a big and diverse state. Of course they should be concerned. Number one, because of 2016 PTSD. Number two, because even though the Trump campaign is short on cash right now, Dan is right. They build a very strong digital and technological operation. Although there is a difference here. All the campaigns now have access to big data in a way they didn't. Mm-hmm. Every day is different in the age of big data. But here's another point. Yes, Joe Biden is struggling some with Latinos in some places. Even a place like Pennsylvania could hurt him. It's not a big population, but if it's close, it matters. However, do you see Joe Biden struggling maybe among black men here, among Latino men there? Remember, that's true, and that's not good for Biden. But he's also doing so much better among senior citizens than Hillary mm-hmm. Clinton, so much better among white voters, especially white men, than Hillary Clinton, even better in the suburbs than Hillary Clinton. So where Joe Biden is behind Hillary Clinton, there are other places where by leaps and bounds he is ahead of Hillary Clinton, cutting into the Trump coalition,
and
especially senior citizens vote.
Yeah, Dana.
I just want to add one thing, because I know that you seem really interested in the underperformance that Biden is seeing in Florida, particularly among African-American and Latino voters. I've talked to a lot of Democrats about this today. What they argue, and the big question is whether they're right, is that culturally, a lot of Latino voters and African-American voters really like to vote on Election right. Day. But the fact that they're seeing, you know, kind of lower numbers than they had hoped really means they have to bank on that, particularly if Joe Biden has any chance of winning Florida, which, you know, could be game over for Donald Trump if that happens. And, you know, obviously, for all of these voters, they're not monolithic, but particularly in Florida, there's, you know, about a third of Latino voters are Cuban Americans. Those almost, for the most part, tend to vote Republican. And then there's a new influx of Puerto Rican voters. That is where some Democrats are very worried that they are not seeing the kind of vote for Joe Biden that they had hoped.
David?
Yeah, I think we have to keep our eye also on the big story here, and that is the avalanche of voters who are coming out. We were over 90 million. We may be up to 100 million by Election Day. And I don't think that's ground game. Particularly for any campaign, I think it's something that's spontaneous. It's happening in the country where just tons and tons of people are coming out because they feel that democracy is at stake, that we're in real trouble here. And most of those people appear to favor Joe Biden. So I think there's something going on here that is bigger than all of us, and we don't really fully understand it, but it may be the basis for a big breakthrough kind of election on the Democrats' part.
David, what are you expecting just in terms of, I mean, if it's close, you know, in votes and this goes to the courts, I guess it's anybody's guess then what happens.
Well, there is mischief and mayhem down that trail, as you well know. But I think you're right to point to if Biden wins, but it's by a tiny margin, say 1-3%, there's no question that we're going to have a flock of new court cases. We're going to be in controversies. People are going to be on the streets. There's a possibility of guns and violence. There are all sorts of nightmare scenarios you can make of this, and some of which wind up with Donald Trump as president. But if he widens that lead, let's say he goes up to 8-10%, then the whole focus is going to change. If he gets up to a high percentage, Anderson, first of all, he makes the controversies go away. Secondly, he takes back the Senate. Thirdly, he takes back state houses, which are really important for redistricting over the next 10 years. Fourthly, he increases his capacity to govern here at home. And fifthly, he will change perception of him, Joe Biden's perception overseas. He will be a much stronger president if he can lift, not just win, but win big.
Yeah. David Gergen, Dana Bash, John King, thank you so much. John's going to join us again later to talk more about what David was talking about, the massive surge of early voting. Coming up next, best-selling author and columnist Thomas Friedman, who believes, in his words, that America itself is on the ballot on Tuesday. And later, a new projection on COVID deaths. You'll see how much better it could be if we all just wore a mask. More than 90,000 new COVID cases today, and the president all in on lying about the pandemic. More than 86 million ballots cast, and both candidates now campaigning as though everything is on the line. And politically, of course, it is. Our next guest, Tom Friedman, best-selling author of Thank You for Being Late and many others, believes far more is at stake, as in everything that makes this country what it is. Quoting the lead paragraph from his latest piece in the New York Times, there is no escaping it. He writes, America is on the ballot on Tuesday. The stability and quality of our governing institutions, our alliances, how we treat one another, our basic commitment to scientific principles and the minimum decency that we expect from our leaders, the whole ball of wax is on the ballot. And Tom Friedman joins us now. Tom, you say that it's not just America on the ballot, that and that this weekend, you said, may be the, quote, last weekend of America. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm sitting here in my home, you know, outside of D.C., Anderson. And I'm really asking myself that question. Is this the last weekend of America as we know it? Because it won't be, certainly, if Joe Biden wins a kind of landslide victory that, you know, your previous commentaries were talking about, if he can win a clear victory. It won't be if Donald Trump wins a clear victory. But if Biden wins a narrow victory, it's very clear what the president is going to do. He's going to challenge every single ballot in every single state. He's going to try to drag out the counting, delegitimize as many votes as possible. And he will create a situation, Anderson, where we will have something we have never had before. We will not be able to elect a legitimate successor president to this president. And when you break something like that, people need to appreciate, when you break something like that, the United States of America and its ability to freely and fairly elect a legitimate successor, getting it back when you break it, boy, that will be really, really hard. So I have a pit in my stomach.
What are the ripple effects of, say that's the scenario, it's too close, you know, it's in the courts, and the courts end up deciding, you know, one candidate refuses to accept it, leaves, you know, whatever happens, what do you think the ripple effects are of that, both in the country and globally?
Well, let's start with the country. You know, Al Gore, back in 2000, bowed to the will of the legitimate Supreme Court. Al Gore took a bullet for the country. Donald Trump will put a bullet into the country in order to stay in power. So let's start there. I think if he does, I think Democratic voters already feel raw and cheated about the way the last two Supreme Court seats were decided and installed in the court. Already raw. If they now see Trump actually try to steal the election by contesting legitimately cast ballots, I think people will be in the streets in very, very large numbers, and eventually there'll be violence. And once it starts, you know, there's no predicting where it can go. When you break something like this incredible system we have been bequeathed by, you know, our forefathers, getting that toothpaste back in the tube will be really, really difficult. And that's why I pray there's only one body that can save us now, Anderson. That's the American people. You know, you don't count on our Secretary of State or our Attorney General or any of these senators. Forget it. It's over. It's too late. The only thing that can save us is if the American people go out and a overwhelming majority of them vote for Joe Biden. And if I have one wish, Anderson, if you were my genie and you said, Tom, you get one wish, what would it be that would be the greatest thing for America? The greatest thing for America would be is if Joe Biden won Texas. Because if Joe Biden won Texas, it would break this fever in the Republican Party. It would blow that party up. The sane, moderate Republicans, I think, would reemerge. I could see then Biden actually forming a national unity government that would include everyone from AOC, you know, on one side to a few Republicans on the other. We actually get back to a national unity government. And the Trumpers, Donald Jr. and Donald Sr. and the whole clown car can go off on Fox and do their thing and start their own network, whatever they want. But my real hope is if somehow Texas, I'll even take Georgia, Anderson, because that would blow up this version of the Republican Party and give us what we desperately need, which is a truly conservative party, not a cult of Trump, because we won't have a healthy liberal party if we don't have a healthy conservative party.
If former Vice President Biden wins Texas, you think that could be a watershed moment for the Republican Party? Can you?
Exactly. Because that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It'll force the reckoning if they lose Texas. That will be such a shock to the system that it'll be the same kind of shock that the two wins that Obama gave them, that they were supposed to force a reckoning. And remember, they did this whole study, you know, to why did we lose? We need to reach out to Hispanics and minorities and women and deal with issues like climate. And then Trump just derailed that whole rethink of Republicanism and turned it into the cult of Trump, which has been so unhealthy for the conservative movement, for conservative ideas, and so unhealthy for the country, because we need a healthy conservative party. If we have a healthy conservative party that actually can collaborate with a healthy liberal party, we can get back to being the country we want to be and need to be.
You write in the latest op-ed in the New York Times about the president saying, if we reelect him, this is a quote, if we reelect him knowing what a norm-destroying, divisive, corrupt liar he is, then the world will not treat the last 4 years as an aberration. It will treat them as an affirmation that we've changed. The world will not just look at America differently, but Americans differently and with good reasons. Well, I mean, what about the idea that America is bigger than any one leader?
Well, you know, it really is this idea that every democracy or many democracies in their histories, Anderson, have taken a flyer on a populist, fast-talking, you know, con man. You know, I come from Minnesota. We had a governor we took a flyer on like that. You know, it happens in history. You can do it once. But when you do it twice, then it's no longer about who he is. It's about who you are. Hmm. The whole world will look differently at us if we were to reaffirm and reelect this man, because then the world will actually start looking at us really like it looks at Russia and China, just another transactional country. They'll look at us as a country that decided to change the Statue of Liberty from giving you, you're tired, you're poor, you know, those seeking, to be free, yearning to be free, to get the hell off my lawn. That's what the Statue of Liberty will be saying. Get the hell off my lawn. And that will affect the whole world. Because, you know, Anderson, the world likes to make fun of America. You know, they love to make fun of our naivete. We think every problem has a solution, you know. But deep down, they envy our naivete. They envy our optimism. Because these are people who come often from very cynical and corrupt countries. And the fact that they always know out there in the world that there's this place called America, somewhere over the rainbow, where they do have free and fair, honest elections, where you can get things done in the court without corruption. Knowing that, that place is out there, and that actually will speak up for human rights and the right values around the world, that is so important for the world. And if we go dark, the whole world goes dark.
Have you seen the country on edge like it has been in these final days?
Never in my life. I just know how I feel, with my family and my friends. I have a hard time watching the news. Because I think, as I said in that column, Anderson, America's on the ballot. Don't kid yourself, folks. Everything's on the ballot. And if there is one thing we have learned about Trump, he does not stop at red lights. There is no bottom there. This is a man also, I think we should come to terms with the fact, people are hoping that his followers will see the light or whatever. He told us early on, that he can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his followers will stay with him. And in those rallies you were showing before, you know, I came on, you can still see that. Mm. The important thing also about defeating Trump, Anderson, is this. The good Lord, he did one good thing for us. He only made one of him. Thank God he only made one of him. And if he is defeated, I don't think you will see someone like that emerge very quickly again. Hmm. Thank God.
Tom Friedman, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
I want to show everyone this. Joe Biden in Milwaukee right now, part of an intense sweep through the Midwest. These final days of the campaign. Early voting numbers key right now for both candidates, obviously. Just ahead, we're going to take a look at those record-breaking numbers, particularly in another area of the country, in Texas, just how big they are and what they may mean for Democrats trying to turn a red state blue. This past several nights, we've been tracking one of the biggest stories of this election, the explosion in early voting numbers. Nearly 87 million have already voted across the nation. Texas leading the way. Its early voting operation wrapped up today, but not before logging more votes just during the early voting period than it did during the entire general election 4 years ago, with still more votes expected, of course, on Election Day. Breaking it down for CNN's John King. John, so the early numbers, I mean, they're really astonishing. It passing the entire vote count for 2016. What does that tell us?
Well, number one, what it does tell us is that Texas is in play this year and that people are excited to vote, whether it's the pandemic for safety reasons or intensity, they're coming out. What it doesn't tell us is that the Democrats can win. It doesn't tell us they can win. But just imagine this scenario, Anderson. This is the map from 2016, right? This is the map from 2016. We focus a lot. We talked earlier in the program. Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. This was the blue wall. Donald Trump cracked it. Can Joe Biden rebuild it? That is the challenge. We're right to talk about that. The election could come down to that. But imagine this. Just imagine if the Democrats actually flip Texas. Look what would happen if nothing else changed. If nothing else changed from the last election in 2016. If all the Clinton states stayed blue, we expect that's a possibility. A couple of them are in play. But if all the Clinton states voted and then the Democrats flipped Texas, Joe Biden would win the presidency. The Democrats could win the presidency without Wisconsin, without Michigan, without Pennsylvania, without North Carolina, without Florida, and so on and so forth. That is why it is such an enticing prize. Can they get it this year? Unclear. We'll know in 4 days. But if they get it, add it to California, add it to New York, we would rewrite the map of American politics. If the Democrats could get Texas, that's why they're trying.
You've covered a lot of presidential campaigns. Texas, but it hasn't gone blue since Jimmy Carter, 76. Are you surprised the state is so competitive this year?
Yes and no. I went to Texas a couple times in my first campaign because that was 88, and Michael Dukakis picked Lloyd Benson, then the Texas senator, to be his running mate. He thought that would help. It didn't. Dukakis lost 40 states. But let me pull out Texas again. I said yes and no. Yes, I'm surprised because Texas is changing demographically. It is becoming more Latino. But one of the frustrations for Democrats is, going back to George W. Bush, Republicans have a pretty good relationship with Latinos here. Watch, Donald Trump will probably do better with Latinos in Texas than he does nationally because of that longstanding conversation back and forth between Texas Republicans and Latinos. The no is this. Donald Trump is accelerating the change in the suburbs. The suburbs revolted in 2018. In 2018, Democrats picked up a House seat here near Dallas. Democrats picked up a House seat here near Houston. There are at least two House seats this time the Democrats can pick up. So the Democrats think the suburban revolt against president is accelerating the transition in Texas. Again, will they get there? We can't be sure, Anderson. We're going to have to watch. But you mentioned the early voting. In Dallas County, it is setting records. In suburban Tarrant County, next to it, it is setting records. And the biggest place of all to watch is one of the fastest growing places in America, Harris County. It is off the charts. If the Democrats can rack up Latino numbers, suburban numbers, they have a chance to redo the map.
Don King, appreciate our perspective now from two veterans of previous presidential campaigns. Stuart Stevens, political consultant and writer, has worked on five Republican campaigns. And Paul Begala, CNN political commentator and Democratic strategist. So, Paul, as a Texan, a veteran campaign operative, do you believe that he has a shot in Texas?
Yes. Yes. And I say that as someone who has watched the Democrats lose. They have lost in the last 25 years. There have been 180 statewide elections in Texas. The Democrats have lost. Let me think. Wait. 180.
Yeah. And also, I just feel like the last couple of years, I keep hearing about Beto O'Rourke was going to win Texas. Hillary Clinton, there was talk about her in Texas. I mean, it never seems to amount to much.
Well, Beto got very close, right? Usually Democrats would lose by solid double digits. Hillary was closer in Texas than she was in Iowa, a state Obama carried. Here's why. It's what King is saying in part. He's wrong about one thing. He's wrong about most things. But this particularly, Hispanics and I love John. We go way back. Hispanics in Texas are trending much more Democratic than they were in the Bush era. This is not George W. Bush's Texas. In fact, Kamala Harris today went to Fort Worth, she went to Houston, very smart. Most importantly, she went to McAllen in the Rio Grande Valley. That's what I'm worried about. The turnout there has not been very high. Half of the Hispanics in Texas live south of San Antonio to the river and from East Texas to El Paso. That South Texas is vitally important. I've been campaigning to get Barack Obama down there. He could turn them out. He could flip the state. It's the changing demographics, but also these changing attitudes of white people. The suburbanites are flocking to Joe Biden and MJ Hagar. MJ is the Senate candidate there. She's a war hero. She's a total badass Texas woman. So yes, yes. And again, I say this as somebody who's been beat there like a bad piece of meat. Texas is in play. Texas can very easily go blue.
Stuart, I mean, the Trump campaign Republicans have been using the courts to try and block mail-in votes from being counted, suing to strike down mail-in ballot extensions. What does it tell you that Trump campaign seemingly wants fewer people voting in this election? I mean, how does one square that with the fundamental tenets of democracy?
Look, there's nothing new about this. This is just classic sort of Jim Crow politics updated for a modern era. It's the same principle that if everybody votes, we're going to lose. And just what does that say about a party? It's terrible. Trump world exists in an America that no longer exists. Therefore, they have to try to reconstruct a world in which they sort of like their own alternative reality. They have to try to increase the number of white votes by decreasing the number of non-white votes. One of the key reasons that Donald Trump won in 2016 was non-white vote decline for the first time in 20 years. Mm. I sure don't think that's going to happen this time. I think we're going to have off the chart non-white votes.
Although
in 2012, although it was the first time.
Although some Democrats, Stuart, some Democrats concerned about African-American early voting of you know, the low numbers of or not as high as expected among African-Americans and some Hispanics in Florida and a couple other states, Arizona and elsewhere.
I think when the day is done, you're going to see a lot higher than you did in 2016. Mm. You may not see in 2012, which is the first time that non-white vote was a higher percentage than white vote of their turnout, but I think you're definitely going to see it increased. And, you know, you're seeing, as you say, with these white votes that the Trump campaign is losing, that Donald Trump is losing, I think it's going to really hurt these down-ticket Senate candidates. They're used to getting those votes. I think a lot of these senators are going to fall because of that.
Paul, campaigns all over the Midwest today. If you were running the Biden campaign, where would you be deploying your resources? I know you said you want Obama to go to Texas.
Yeah, I actually think where they're sending Joe and Kamala is exactly right. You can't take your eyes off the prize. If you rebuild that blue wall, much as I want Texas, by the way, I think Georgia's going to flip, more likely than even Texas. But much as I want those states, you got to repair the damage done in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. The Democrats have been working very, very hard there. And I was struck at the closing arguments. Joe's closing argument is about healing, both literal with COVID, as we lost now 292,000 Americans, and metaphorical. I think that's where the country is. The president's, though, his message has changed. I'm curious what Stuart thinks about this. In 2016, at the end especially, it was about your grievances on trade, on immigration, things that make you angry. Now it's just his grievances. He's whining about the media. He's even whining about the weather. Why do I have to be in Erie? Even when he talks about COVID and the collapse, it's about how it affects him. So, you know, he's lost the thread of even that which worked for him in 2016.
Stuart, what do you think of that?
Well, I think Paul's right. He's a white grievance candidate. The problem he has now is that the greatest grievance that America has is COVID, and he denies COVID. He's out there now attacking doctors, saying there's some plot to kill people because they'll make more money. I mean, I just really don't think attacking doctors is a great closing message for a presidential race in the middle of a pandemic. It's just completely atonal. So they're floundering. And I think that the message of Joe Biden is one that is just, it's very calming. It's very consistent with who he is. And it just seems real. He's a man who can speak to healing and grief in a unique way.
Stuart Stevens, Paul Begala, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks.
Just ahead, the biggest issue this campaign, the coronavirus, as we were just talking about, the president trying to downplay it, but a new estimate shows just how much more deadly it may become this winter, far from rounding the turn. That discussion when we return. Quick note about the last segment. One of our guests said that 290,000 Americans have died of COVID. The actual number is lower. It's 229,000. Earlier, we showed you President Trump at a rally today insinuating the doctors are inflating the numbers of those dead from the coronavirus. Again, they're not. It's obscene that the president is suggesting this. Seems odd to be attacking the very people who are defending us and trying to save lives and, in fact, maybe save the president's life from this virus. According to a newly released model, the number of dead could be 399,000 by February 1st. That's an increase of 15,000 since just the last estimate. Joining me now is Dr. Chris Murray, director of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington, whose team published the model, also our chief medical correspondent, Dr. Sanjay Gupta. So, Dr. Murray, the latest forecast, it's possibly the most dire we've ever seen. It predicts by the middle of January, 2,250 Americans will be dying every day from coronavirus. I mean, that's more than double the current fatality rate. Can you just explain how you got that?
Sure, Anderson. It's that, you know, we're entering the fall winter surge that's really largely being driven by COVID being seasonal. And so we expect increased transmission. Look what's happening in Europe. They're going into major lockdown because they're 3-4 weeks ahead of us. And then the other factor is that our governments are not responding to the uptick in cases, hospitalizations, and now deaths. And put the two together, and we have a very grim winter ahead.
I mean, what a sentence. Our governments are not responding to the uptick in cases. Sanjay, I know you have a question for Dr. Murray, and I just want to note we've, you know, crossed 90,000 cases in a single day for the first time.
Yeah, Dr. Murray, you just talked about Europe, and, you know, they do seem to be a bit of a precursor for us as we are watching them in the spring. But are there lessons then that we should be taking from the EU? And is there some indication that the United States is going to behave any differently, or is this sort of preordained at this point?
Well, I think what we're seeing in Europe, it's pretty interesting. You know, there's a lot of discussion across the different countries in Europe, different strategies. But suddenly, I think as you've had, you know, basically 5 or 6 weeks of exponential growth, people are hitting the panic button there and going back into very strict lockdown in some countries. The big question is, can we use things like, you know, universal mask use, you know, avoiding large gatherings and having people who have the ability to work from home, you know, stay working from home? Can we use that to put off the time when we're going to be forced into much more strict lockdown? And I think that's the challenge for us as a nation.
You think it's inevitable that there will be stricter lockdowns?
You know, I think if you look at our scenario around, you know, 95% of people wearing masks, a lot of states can put off mandates, you know, right well into the winter, maybe throughout the whole winter. If you look at what happened in Victoria State in Australia, they were able to get mask use up to, you know, incredibly high levels in a very short period of time. So if we can do that, we can defer lockdowns for many months.
So you're saying that if states, if they don't react to the rising cases by enacting stricter mandates, then you project 399,000 total coronavirus deaths by February 1st. And that could rise to 514,000 deaths if, is that right?
Yeah,
if states don't impose those mandates.
Our figure 399,000 is trying to build into the modeling what we think states will do. And we think when things get really bad, if you wait till it's really late and then put back in social distancing measures, that's where we get our 399,000 figure. And if you do nothing, you get a much worse winter ahead. And that's the 500,000 plus figure. But I think we can use things like masks to bring the not only save lives, but also put off having to put these much stricter controls in place. You know, in our numbers this week, we see that 18 states are going to have real stress on their ICUs in the months of December and January, maybe actually, you know, over capacity. And that's a real prospect on the horizon.
Dr. Murray, I mean, we talk about the overall number of people who are infected, but the hospitalization numbers, as you're mentioning, you think that that's probably the truest sort of measure of what's actually happening in the country. I mean, I wonder if you agree with that. But also, when you talk about this stress, do you have the data to be able to really predict how much stress there's going to be on these hospital systems? I've been trying to get this data myself, different counties, different states. Sometimes it's hard to obtain. Do you have the data, and do you think that that's going to be the truest sort of measure of what's happening here?
So hospitalizations are definitely our best measure. They're a leading indicator in front of deaths, and they don't suffer from the sensitivity of the case numbers to who you test and how much you test.
Right.
So we really put a lot of faith in the hospitalization numbers. We don't have all the data, and we know, and it's been in the media this week, that the government has really good data on daily hospitalizations by hospital, by age, by sex, you know, by race, ethnicity. They're not releasing it to the public. It would be a really big help for us to understand where we are in the epidemic and who's going to have, you know, hospitals that are severely under stress going forward.
Why aren't they releasing that data? I'm just curious. I mean, because I've been trying to get it as well.
You know, I wrote an editorial in the New York Times about this, and quite honestly, I don't know. It's in so much in the public's interest to have that data out for the whole of the public, the media, the research community, to help guide us through the course of the epidemic. The only thing I can imagine is that there are things in the data that they don't really, you know, want the public discussing.
Wow. Jeez. That's where we are. That's the reality now. Sanjay, thank you. Dr. Murray, as always, thank you so much for your work. We appreciate your time. There's more breaking news next. A day after Walmart announces it was pulling guns and ammunition from the sale from the sales aisles over concerns of social unrest, the company changes course. Details when we continue. There's breaking news tonight. A day after Walmart announced it would remove firearms and ammunition from its sales aisles, it abruptly changed course. In its original statement yesterday, the retailer said it was taking the move because of what it called isolated civil unrest and was removing firearms and ammunition as a, quote, precaution for the safety of our associates and our customers. Walmart spokesman said one reason was that several of its stores were damaged earlier this week. Company said guns and ammo would still be available for purchase. Late today, however, the company said the products would begin to return to sales floors. The reason those incidents have remained, quote, geographically isolated, according to a Walmart spokesperson. Back in June, Walmart instituted similar measures in some of its stores following nationwide protests over the death of George Floyd in Minnesota. Reminder, after a race like no other, join us for election results, the way only CNN can bring it to you. See what's happening in your state, across the country during our Election Night in America coverage on Tuesday. It starts at 4 p.m. Eastern. When it ends, we shall see. One more programming note. We'll be with you all weekend with special editions of 360 on both Saturday and Sunday. So tomorrow and Sunday night from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern. I hope you join me for that. News continues right now. Let's hand it over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime. Chris?
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.